Hello, welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and today we're going to talk about Syria, different aspects of the struggle of the pretty much a well-oiled attempt by the State Department and the Pentagon and NATO to cause regime change in Syria and all the various techniques. We'll be talking to Chris Black about international law and the meddling of former chief prosecutor of the ICC, Luis Ocampo. And then later we're gonna have last week's visitor, but Zafar Benghazi, he is going to be here this week. I bungled it, I'm proud to say it. I fouled up on the organization of it. But Zafar is going to be with us, and Zafar knows the area about as well as anybody can know it. And there is a lot of news. For example, there's been a bombing. The Israelis apparently today fired on the Syrians, which is a little sobering. We'll have to find out what all this could mean. We'll also maybe, Phil and I, Phil Connell is here. How you doing?
Hi, Phil.
We'll say a few things about the Lincoln film. I did my duty. I went to see it and was suitably unimpressed, so we'll have to say something about that. I want to ask you, Phil, you have a program, Classical Underground, and you're going to feature something special tomorrow.
Yes, tomorrow, and I hope everyone will listen in. We are going to play the rarely heard Shostakovich Symphony No. 12, which is subtitled 1917. And Shostakovich wrote this symphony to commemorate the events of that year when the Russian Revolution, and that work is being performed by the Toronto Symphony this week on Wednesday and Thursday evenings. Uh-huh. And it's very rarely heard. I've never heard a live performance of it before, as an example. So please listen in tomorrow at noon. We're going to play 1917, right. Symphony No. 12 by Dmitri Shostakovich.
Yeah, well, that's dramatic. And I hope people do that. And we're joined now, I believe, by Christopher Black. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am. Hi. How are you doing, Phil?
Very well, and we're glad to be talking to you because you've practiced law and this new thing called international law, and you've been at The Hague where you've been associated with the defense of Mr. Milosevic and others, and of course you're at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And a celebrated figure from the International Criminal Court, I should say, personally, I would like to say he's notorious, that is Luis Ocampo. He was recently visiting Canada, and he gave a speech, and he also got interviewed by the CBC, and his contribution on the Syria crisis was to talk about how they could go about charging the president of Syria, Mr. Assad.
Mm-hmm.
I take it you, for one, weren't terribly impressed by that, or... And we need to know, what do you make of that stuff? And by the way, why are they talking to him? He's the former guy, and he didn't have an unblemished record.
No. No, I'm not sure why he's circulating these days. His comments were quite clearly nothing more than war propaganda, because the ICC has no jurisdiction in Syria, because it's not a party to the Treaty of Rome. And the only way it could get, some people say, jurisdiction is a reference from the Security Council, which is not going to happen. So he was talking through his hat, and it seemed to me that when I saw that interview, it seemed the whole thrust was to convince the Canadian public that Assad was a criminal,
mm-hmm.
and therefore should be gotten rid of. And this whole talk about possible indictments was just an excuse to have that discussion, because yeah. even he admitted to the CBC reporter that, well, it's not likely you're going to get an indictment issued by it because there's no reference from the Security Council possible with the position of Russia and China and everybody else.
Yeah.
So what you have Ocampo doing is what Luis Arbour did when they attacked Yugoslavia, is justifying aggression against a country on jumped-up charges. You know, he repeated that the propaganda that of the Americans and the British that he's killing civilians and bombing civilians, mm-hmm. which is totally nonsense. Total nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's the other way around. The NATO rebels, supported rebels, so-called, are the ones killing civilians,
mm-hmm.
and they should be the ones.
And by the way, putting it up on YouTube so we can all watch.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And it's outrageous. The NATO countries, Britain and United States in particular, and Turkey, are openly conspiring to attack another member of the UN and bypass the United Nations again because they can't get what they want through the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
And they risk Third World War by what they're suggesting, with Cameron suggesting that Britain try and send the RAF to establish a no-fly zone over Syria. Well, we all know what will happen. Those planes will all be shot down. There'll be a major war. Mm-hmm. It's just very dangerous what they're talking about.
Yeah, by the way, if it's true, I mean, if the ICC was actually for real, and you had someone there to guarantee protect international law and to charge people who violate it, Mr. Cameron's behavior would qualify. I mean,
he's
talking about sovereign airspace of Syria, which he says he could overfly that if he wants. He could bomb Syrians if he feels like it.
Yeah, what you have is conspiracy. It's an open conspiracy. They're openly conspiring to commit war crimes, to commit an act of aggression. I mean, the ICC has enough grounds right now, because Britain is a member of the ICC, is under the jurisdiction of the ICC. The United States is not, but Britain is. Mm-hmm. Cameron could be charged for making those comments.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows he will never be charged. Because
mm-hmm.
as Tony Blair said in some speech, the ICC wasn't established to charge us. That's quite clear.
Yes. Well, indeed. So. I mean, well, you know some things about this. Wasn't it Madeleine Albright that Louise Arbour described as the mother of the...
Yes, she's the mother of all these tribunals, the ICTR, the ICTY, the Syria loan there. The Lebanon mm-hmm. Tribunal. The ICC is just what they've done is amalgamate or consolidate that idea into one so-called world court,
mm-hmm.
which the big powers don't play by, of course, mm-hmm. don't abide by.
Yeah. This is Christopher Black. He's a prominent lawyer here at Toronto, but has had a lot of international attention to the cases. He's fought very brilliantly in the case of Rwanda and did his best in The Hague. Particularly, though, the defense of General Dindi Limana was... Chris, I would say, if people would go and just read your trial, they would be highly enlightened about the improper functioning of these tribunals and the abuse of power by people from them.
Right.
I know it's somewhat accessible, but it's hard work, isn't it, to get the actual record?
Well, yeah, because the public aren't allowed to see the transcripts. So if people knew what actually went on in the trials, if people could really read the transcripts of what went on in the Milosevic trial, for instance, and how he showed that he was completely innocent of any of the charges against him, and it was the NATO generals who were really guilty of war crimes, and the same in Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
that the government in place, the coalition government, they always say it's a Hutu government, it was a Tutsi-Hutu coalition government, which had agreed to the peace plan, was overthrown, the president assassinated, and then attacked, but with the support of Canada, America, Britain, Belgium, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the victims are called criminals and thrown in prison,
mm-hmm.
whereas Kagame and all the people that backed him are still roaming around murdering people all over Africa and now in Syria and Libya and everywhere else.
Yes, it is... A strange spin out of all this. I was speaking to a Somali politician recently who told me that practically all the troops in Somalia enforcing the authority there are from states that have invaded other states and committed crimes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Rwandans,
right.
the Burundians, who are notorious.
Yes.
And often forgotten, by the way. And, of course, that's Rwanda's twin. And then there's Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
They farm out their soldiers, and they basically act as mercenaries
right.
when they're not invading their neighbors.
Exactly. So NATO uses the proxy armies. Well, they just pay these governments to use their forces as mercenary mm-hmm. forces for them. That's clear. But it's shocking to see lawyers. I mean, I was shocked at all the defense lawyers were shocked by the lack of morality any sense of ethics or legality among the prosecution staff at these tribunals, and that people were willing to pull every trick in the book, including intimidation and death threats and bribing and intimidating witnesses were killed. Anything goes. It's a gangster world
mm-hmm.
disguised as a legal world.
Yeah, and they've created a little gulag of prisoners that they've scattered around Africa under their aegis, but also people who were acquitted are being held in, and your client is among those who he won on most of the points in his case, and he also, his time has been served, but there's nowhere they can go, right?
No, they're all stuck in exile. So even though they're acquitted, and the countries in which they're arrested, like Dingy Limana was arrested in Belgium, and France and Belgium are the main two countries. Mm-hmm. Those countries agreed to cooperate with the UN and deliver these men over to the ICTR tribunal, which means you would think if they were acquitted, they would accept them back, but no.
Yeah.
They've all been acquitted, but they're stuck in Africa
yeah.
in a safe house, a UN safe house, and can't move and face assassination threats by the RPF.
Yeah. No, it's just to me, I think we ought to make them wear that name. It is a gulag. They run it. They close the door on these individuals.
Yes.
Just as they did with the man Baragwiza, who was ordered to be released with prejudice, let him out today. And they all blinked and did not let him out, and he died in prison.
Right, and you have now Milosevic dying under mysterious circumstances in 2006. You have President Gbagbo hasn't even been charged yet. He's been in prison now for almost a year.
And his
wife. And he's not even formally charged with anything. And he's been taken out of the political situation in Cote d'Ivoire.
Yeah. Which is exactly what this is all about. I got to ask you, Chris, about this that issue. You raised this with, and I'm very happy that you did. I don't know if you've written about it, but I've seen comments of yours.
Mm-hmm.
That of the, you know, that someone ought to say to someone like Ocampo, you know, you, by shooting your mouth off, might be committing a crime or inciting others.
Right.
And then, but that brings me also to the present Secretary General of the United Nations. He had United Nations armed helicopters firing into the presidential palace of Cote d'Ivoire.
Yes.
That looks like it might be a crime. I could see certainly the president himself thinking it was, since they were firing at him. But isn't it time that maybe we ought to start throwing down the gauntlet to these guys, saying, you know, you actually can't just go around broadly saying these things. You have to be responsible.
Right, and I heard that there's evidence that 1,500 people were shot down by French and UN helicopters mm-hmm. when they attacked the presidential palace and arrested Gbagbo. They killed maybe 1,500, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done by the UN and French forces. And they were unarmed civilians.
Yes.
And yet they arrested Gbagbo, but Sarkozy's not arrested. And Ban Ki-moon's not arrested.
Yes. No, I say that specter has got to be raised, because it just seems that unless people speak up, they're going to figure that they have license, that they can just do these things.
Yeah.
That might be another chapter for lawyers like yourself. I know you fought back very hard. You recently were at The Hague trying to get charges in relation to the conduct of Kagame.
Yeah, and that was we were ignored there. We asked to meet with a new ICC prosecutor whose name's Fatou Bensouda. And we got palmed off with an excuse that she was busy. Well, she wasn't doing anything all day, and we got palmed off with some functionaries. So we filed the document, the complaint, but she's done nothing. And yet, despite there are other reports by even the UN itself that Kagame is responsible for war crimes in the Congo, they still haven't laid a charge against him.
Yeah.
And why? Because Fatou Bensouda was a prosecutor at the ICTR, which had the policy of protecting Kagame for all the massacres he committed in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So she was part of that team which approved that policy. Yeah. So she's protecting war criminals her entire career, and she'll go on doing so.
Well, by the way, the document you presented, could we, for example, get that and post it somewhere?
Yes, you could. I'll send you a copy.
But make sure we'd like to post it, and I suppose other organizations are doing that. But we're speaking to Christopher Black, who is experienced with dealing with the ICC and the ad hoc United Nations tribunals at The Hague and in Arusha, Tanzania. And Chris, you had a dear colleague who recently passed. We had a memorial. There was a memorial event at Convocation Hall on Saturday. Charles Roach. Could you talk just a little bit about how we should assess Charles Roach's career?
Yeah, I think he was important because he was one of the few lawyers. There are some in Toronto. I don't want to treat lightly the other lawyers in Toronto who do great work, but Charles was a particular man who was dedicated to using the law for political purposes. That is, he didn't think law was just restricted to being a technician and going to court and getting cases won on technical basis. He tried to help people by using the law as a political tool, and trying to help people that way. And when I was working with him between, say, in the early 90s, I guess, 1995, roughly in that period, I learned a lot from him about how a lawyer could escape the box and think outside the box and try and use the law and legal techniques to accomplish things, to accomplish social policy changes and legal and changes in the law and changes in attitudes towards. For instance, he was very important in trying to lessen the racism in Toronto and the effects of racism on the black population, the African population here. Mm-hmm. And I think he succeeded in a large number of cases and was a catalyst for that.
And he helped us with the International Tribunal fight.
Yes, he was.
And, you know, I congratulate you, but also, I mean, Charles, I remember, was one of the people who convened the meeting and mm-hmm. and said, you know, somebody's going to have to defend these accused at a time when, you know, the classic situation where they're receiving so much abuse and so many wild charges were being thrown around. It took brave lawyers to stand up.
Yeah, I remember, I think Charlie arranged. There was a meeting in Toronto where we had a small conference where he promoted that, and we were attacked at the meeting by pro-RPF people in the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he was very important in establishing at the beginning of the tribunal, getting people active, and Canadian lawyers especially, and especially from Ontario, to go into the tribunal and try and help these people because they were being railroaded. And he was a lawyer for Matthew Ngurumpatsi, mm-hmm. one of the important men of the MRND political party in Rwanda, which mm-hmm. they were trying to demonize so it can't take part in politics in Rwanda.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was very important in that.
Okay. So, well, I really appreciate, Chris, your remarks, and it's very, very helpful that you've focused on the misbehavior of the prosecutors and the whole ICC operation. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Okie doke.
Take care.
Bye bye. That's Christopher Black, Toronto lawyer, and he has a distinguished record on the international stage of, I'd say, showing up the, as I just said, the peculiar behavior of the, or maybe we ought to call it the obedient behavior of the International Tribunal, the obedient to the U.S. State Department. There aren't, so far, the ICC has only charged Africans, which should be the end of it. They've been in existence for a decade. So they should go back to the United Nations and say, so you're looking for war criminals, and the only ones you found are African. You're finished. Forget it. Let's start again, because all the weapons are manufactured elsewhere. All the great powers who distribute those weapons are elsewhere. And they're not Africans. They're white, and they've been there a long time. Look in New York, Paris, London. You just for a start. You could always go to Brussels, but that would help. Yesterday was the 11th day, the 11th hour of the. The missing element to my mind in the memorial business is that, and I agree, I think it was Thomas Walkham ran a column about this. The Harper people and the other parties, frankly, too much are allowing this to happen, are turning this all into a celebration of the new thing of warriorness. And it's all about, well, they gave their lives for us and we're so grateful. Well, they gave their lives, all right. Actually, if an us exists, us is supposed to have some duties, some responsibilities. One would be, what did you do to prevent the war in which all these wonderful people died? Some by the tens of thousands, eventually millions. What was done, or were you just a guy with a bugle and a drum and helped them die? And why did you call it the war to end all wars and then stop calling it that? Because you had another one, and then you use nuclear weapon. It's time for civilians to act like civilians and to stop being overawed by a guy with medals on his chest. Like a wonderful guy like Petraeus, for example. There's a guy with a whole bunch of medals down to his you know, all the way to his waist. And waist is the right word. At any rate, there's a good poem I know by, you know, Hugh McDermott, who a great Scottish nationalist, and he was also a communist. They used to ask him to explain. I don't know that he could, but at any rate, Hugh McDermott had a poem in which he said, "A war to save civilization, you say, and what have you to do with it, pray? Some attempt to acquire it would show greater love than fighting for something you know nothing of." Which to me captures it. Hugh McDermott, I have to do one of these name dropping things. He must be a great poet. The reason I know is that W. H. Auden told me so. But at any rate, we should be attacking, speaking up about this. This is outrageous that that people don't say, instead of saying, "Oh, they went to Afghanistan because the Americans wanted them to, and then they got killed there sometimes by Americans." You know, a number of Canadians were killed in what was called friendly fire, where, you know, a jet plane flies by and you say, "I wonder what he's doing." And then you find out because something goes boom about a quarter mile away, if you're lucky. And to achieve what? I didn't see that they achieved anything. They all seem to be back. They don't seem to want to go again. So, you know, we're in a pathetic situation if people don't say, "Well, let's hear from the peacemakers." I think that the Quakers ought to be given the podium. Every, you know, when we're going to talk about war, allow the Quakers to talk, because they would say, "Well, you know, we did mention that if you go enter into these things, terrible things will happen." And they were consistent. And so if anyone had listened to them, paid attention to the facts, we wouldn't have had so many people lost. But to continually praise warriors is just irksome. And I think we should protest that. I say that, by the way, as a former Marine. My father was a Marine. Both my brothers were Marines. But so the idolization of people in uniform, the thing of people who listen to this show know I complain about it a lot, people running around in dungarees saying they're honoring the troops. I said, no, go and be one. But if you're a high school football coach, I don't want to see you in your camouflage gear. You're not honoring anybody. You're making yourself look like a kid, and it's childish. But also, I can say from being in, you know, sitting around in the barracks, that we didn't have any use for civilians, and there was no this. And the conversation I heard was generally heavily racist. That we didn't have any nice words for Asians. There was only one or two words, and we used it every time. So when you see this peculiar behavior, like the officers who showed, did you see that, Phil, that they put on a blackface? It was apparently a kind of it's a minstrel show in which they pretended to be East Indians or something. And then they say, "Well, they were just joking. See, these are rough, tough military people." I said, "Well, throw them out of the military, because if that's, they're the warrior face of the country, then we're, you don't have much of a, your army is contemptible." But there is, see, this latitude given to military people. If you call them warriors and you put them on podiums, pedestals, you're really endangering everybody, in my opinion. So we need to, I think maybe the anti-war people ought to start showing up at the memorials with banners and signs and that sort of thing, and say, you know, an honor roll of the generals who ordered men into combat, lost their lives, who, in order just to add another stripe on their, you know, on their shirt front. I think we will take a break, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more, and then we will speak to Zafar Bengash.